From Vermont to Mississippi, Illinois to Arizona, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, many states across the nation will be electing governors this year. John Gizzi from Newsmax is here with an overview. Current political trends favor Republicans in their efforts to regain control of Congress. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on the state-by-state races. President Joe Biden is attempting to blame the skyrocketing inflation rate on Vladimir Putin and the war in Ukraine. But Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains inflation was already out of control well before the war began. On this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says weakness breeds aggression, and America should provide Ukraine with the weapons needed to defend themselves. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Voters in a number of states will be electing a governor this year, along with a variety of statewide offices. State houses tend to be a rung on the political ladder to national office, and gubernatorial races are often a bellwether of public opinion. Joining us with a look at these races is John Gizzi. He is White House correspondent and chief political columnist for Newsmax. John, welcome back to American Radio Journal. John, a lot of the attention is on the U.S. Senate and the fact it's evenly divided. We have all these United States Senate races going on all around the country, but we also have a number of states that are going to be electing governors this year. Just as an overview, how many states are electing governors this year?
Well, a grand total of 36 are electing governors, and this is going to be quite a year because we have some national figures and potential presidential candidates that are on the ballot vying for the state house before they go to the White House.
Let's talk first of all about those governors. Are we talking mainly about Republican governors who are looking at potentially candidacies for the Republican presidential nomination? Any Democrat governors looking at this point?
None who are on the ballot this year, but remember, as the late Edward R. Murrow once said, little men become big men, and big men become giants eventually. You can have some people emerge from the gubernatorial races who in 2 years would go on to be on a national ticket. I'm just thinking aloud now, and if either Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York, who succeeded disgraced fellow Democrat Andrew Cuomo, wins big, she almost certainly would be mentioned as a presidential candidate. At the same time, Congressman Lee Zeldin, if he is elected, would be the first Jewish Republican governor of New York and someone who could be on a national ticket as well. So I'm saying out of these races, someone could emerge. Likewise, Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida is the candidate that people will back if Donald Trump doesn't run, and many will back him if he does run. People will be looking at just how big he wins re-election by. And Kristi Noem of South Dakota, also mentioned as a presidential or vice presidential candidate, by all accounts headed toward a big win. So there's a lot of national stories there. One more thing. In Arkansas, all signs are for a resounding nomination and election of Sarah Sanders as the first woman Republican governor, or the first woman governor, I should say. Who, if you're listening, Sarah, I had to get that one right. But the fact is that people know her as President Trump's press secretary, the longest stint of any press secretary, and as the daughter of the beloved former governor Mike Huckabee. She will be mentioned as a national figure overnight.
So we have some big names out there that may have future big things in store for them. Let's talk about some pickup opportunities for each party. Let's start with Democrats. Right now, there are Republicans sitting in Massachusetts and Maryland, two typically blue states. They would seem to be, John, to loom largest pickup opportunities for the Democrats?
Absolutely. and Governor Larry Hogan, a Republican, extremely popular with the people and loved because of his battle against cancer. He is termed out, not running for another office this year, and Democrats are likely to take advantage of the 3-1 Democratic registration edge in the free state. Similarly, Massachusetts, Charlie Baker, 2-term Republican governor, could have easily won a third term, but he just had had enough. So both of those are likely to flip.
As for Republicans, there are a number of states that are either sort of purplish states like Pennsylvania or more blue states like Michigan that have races this year that are competitive. Tell us a bit, John, about what's happening in those states.
Right. In Pennsylvania, you've got certainly a lot of Republicans interested, 12, in fact, and Democrats have apparently settled on Attorney General Josh Shapiro, a very formidable candidate and a very vigorous campaigner. The joke is he goes to the opening of an envelope. On the Republican side, I would be hesitant to pick out a favorite, except to say there's a variety of flavors out there, from solid Trump in Doug Mastriano to establishment in Senate Majority Leader Jake Corman, to the old familiar faces, Lou Barletta, former congressman and past candidate for the United States Senate, Bill McSwain, a U.S. attorney. If I missed anyone, I'm probably going to upset them a bit. But the very fact you have so many candidates and such diversity in the group is a clear sign that Republicans are not conceding the Keystone State in any way, shape, or form. And in Michigan, of course, Governor Gretchen Whitmer has been controversial because of the lockdown that many say lasted too long in the state. People thought she would win sympathy because of an alleged kidnap plot. And many now within the Wolverine state are saying that this plot was the gang that couldn't shoot straight that was egged on by federal agents infiltrating them. In any event, she has not gotten a lot of sympathy, and there are 7 Republicans running for the nomination for governor. The likely winner is the man admirers call the toughest cop in America, James Craig, former police chief of Detroit, familiar picture on Fox News, and someone who is conservative and would be the likely beneficiary of the anti-Whitmer sentiment, according to most polls. That will be a nationally watched race. And by the way, there has not been a Republican governor who happens to be black since Reconstruction.
We have been talking with John Gizzi, who joins us from time to time. He is White House correspondent and chief political columnist for Newsmax. And John, if we have listeners who would like to read your pretty much daily columns on Newsmax, where can they go to find that?
www.newsmax.com.
John Gizzi of Newsmax. John, thank you for being here.
Always a pleasure, Loman.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, in addition to keeping tabs on key actions in Congress, also follows the political developments in states all around the country. John Gizzi filled us in a couple of minutes ago on governor races, so we're going to turn to the U.S. Senate and get caught up on those races with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Overall, what would you say is the mood of the country, Scott? It seems like every election, whether it be a presidential year or one of these so-called off-year elections, even though there's never really an off-year, there always is sort of a prevailing mood or Big Mo, as George H.W. Bush once said. What do you see this year?
Well, I think that there's a lot of voters that are looking back at their decisions in 2020 and they're like, is this really what we voted for? President Biden is clearly the dominant political figure in Washington, D.C., but that trickles down to his ability to carry out an agenda within the United States Senate and the House of Representatives. And when we look at the makeup of the Senate, we know that it's a 50-50 Senate, that Kamala Harris has cast, I think, about 17 tie-breaking votes. And most of the Biden nominees are going through. We're right now considering another associate justice on the Supreme Court. And then you also look at sort of the political scene and in what's happened with Afghanistan, with federal spending, all the stimulus spending that Biden advocated for, with the bipartisan infrastructure framework, and also with the Biden stimulus plan last March. Now we're obviously dealing with international crisis with what's happening in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine and Russia. And I think a lot of voters are just wondering, how did we go from an era of COVID where we thought we'd be able to turn the page, and here we are, we're still wrestling with this virus, and Congress is still taking steps to remove mask mandates on airplanes, and they're trying to get rid of vaccine mandates, and there's a lot going on and all that stuff. But the bottom line is, it seems like the feelings from voters that are being heard here in Washington is that they're discontent with the unified government that Democrats are operating under, that it's been highly partisan, even though they hold very slim majorities within the House of Representatives, just a few seats, and then in the United States Senate, 50-50 with the tie-breaking vote being Kamala Harris.
That 50-50 Senate, Scott, of course, sets up an election year where every state, every seat up is going to matter. Right now, take a look at some of the key races for us. What states do you see shaping up as being the battleground states for the U.S. Senate?
No doubt about it. There's four of them. Right at the top of the list needs to be Arizona. Arizona's a really competitive state with Mark Kelly running for re-election. We know that it's a sort of a competitive Republican primary. The Club for Growth PAC has endorsed Blake Masters in that race. He's running against the Attorney General, Mark Brunovich. And then you've also got a self-funder businessman named Jim Lehman and a few other candidates. And so that's a competitive race, but we know Mark Kelly's a strong candidate in the general election. Nonetheless, Arizona's one of those big seats that we need to flip to get back the United States Senate majority. Then I would go over to Georgia, and you've got a strong fundraiser when it comes to Herschel Walker. I think that it's very clear that he's the front runner in the Republican primary. Seems like, you know, he's going to run away with that one. But then in the general election, he'll be facing Raphael Warnock. Then I would jump back out west and go to Nevada. Nevada, you've got Senator Cortez Masto, who is running for re-election. And the Republican competitive candidates are Adam Laxalt. He's endorsed by the Club for Growth PAC as well. And Adam is running against a war hero named Sam Brown. And so within the two of them, we feel really strong about Laxalt's ability to carry that through. His family name has high name ID in the state, but he's also run statewide as recently as 2018 in a really competitive race for governor. And Nevada is a swing state. We've held it statewide office there with Brian Sandoval, also with John Ensign and Dean Heller. So I think that that's a real flip opportunity. Then I would come way back out to the east, and this is more of a long shot opportunity in some regards, but New Hampshire is definitely the fourth opportunity to pick up a seat. And within that race, you have a Senate president named Chuck Morse, who has, I think, kind of come out the gate in this quarter and is, you know, perceived to do really well with his fundraising. He has a conservative record in the Senate leadership, but he's also running against a general named Don Boldock, who's given it another shot. Don ran last cycle as well. And then there's one other candidate that, you know, is sort of perceived as a conservative candidate. And I think that race is probably going to be Chuck Morse, just given he seems to be embraced by the leadership structure that a state like New Hampshire traditionally is going to promote.
And there are a couple of Republican seats that could be in play for the Democrats as well.
Yeah, your state is probably right at the top of that list, Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth. Look, I think that Pat Toomey, he's a former president at the Club for Growth and was a very solid conservative senator when it came to economic freedom and championing free market policies. Nonetheless, he decided to retire, and the Republican primary has been wide open. I don't think anybody really wants to take the real front runner posture there, but we got a couple of guys that are spending millions of dollars to do that. One of them is Dr. Mehmet Oz, and then the other one is hedge fund manager named Dave McCormick. And McCormick appears to be in the lead right now as we approach the primary date in May.
We will, of course, be keeping an eye on all of these races as the political winds sort of shift around from time to time. Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Today we were talking about Club for Growth's PAC that makes endorsements in federal races, and we're starting to make them in governor's races as well. Our membership is over 500,000. You can check us out on clubforgrowth.org, and you can actually become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Okay, thank you.
Biden administration policies, not the war in Ukraine, are responsible for the hyperinflation gripping the nation. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports.
The White House's latest attempt to scapegoat higher prices throughout the economy is to blame Russian President Vladimir Putin for the entire mess. And look, Putin's a bad guy, but ignoring everything that happened before the past 3 weeks misses a big part of the story about what's happening with inflation. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a closer look at what I think is, quite frankly, a dishonest attempt by the Biden administration to pin inflation on Vladimir Putin. And again, of course, none of what I'm about to say absolves Putin of the responsibility for Russia's invasion of Ukraine, a completely unjustified and unprovoked attack. And while the war in Ukraine is certainly having an impact on gas prices, I think it's just completely misleading to suggest that that's the root cause or the underlying reason why we're seeing record levels of inflation across the economy. And the reason you know this is because you can go back and look at what happened more than just 3 weeks ago. You can go back, for example, to 10 months ago when Jeremy Siegel, a professor of finance at University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, was a guest on CNBC. This was May 14th of last year, just shortly after President Joe Biden and Congress had passed the American Rescue Plan. And this is what Professor Siegel had to say at the time.
The money supply since the beginning of the pandemic, so a little over a year, has gone up almost 30%. Now, that money is not going to disappear. That money's going to find its way into spending and higher prices. Now, not all of it's going to go. We're not going to have 30% inflation. But I predicted here that over the next 2-3 years, we could easily have 20% inflation with this increase in the money supply.
Siegel was hardly the only one sounding the alarm about higher inflation. A few months earlier, just before Congress passed that $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan, several prominent economists had warned that the stimulus bill, which was the third major one passed since the outbreak of COVID-19 just a year earlier, they said it was too big and that it threatened to overheat the economy. Among the critics were people like Larry Summers, who served as Treasury Secretary during the Obama administration. Summers wrote a Washington Post op-ed in February of 2021, warning that, quote, there is a chance that macroeconomic stimulus on a scale closer to World War II levels than normal recession levels will set off inflationary pressures of a kind we have not seen in a generation. Summers went on to say that the administration was dismissing the possibility of inflation and the difficulties in mobilizing congressional support for tax increases or spending cuts, which meant that the risk of inflation expectations were rising sharply. Again, that's February of 2021, when Obama's Treasury Secretary was warning the Biden administration against this plan. And other economists were saying the same thing. Olivier Blanchard, the former chairman of the International Monetary Fund, right around the same time, said that we did not need to spend $1.9 trillion and that we should have a smaller stimulus program. He warned that, quote, strong inflation would be the natural result of dumping that much more money into the economy. This would not just be overheating, he said, it would be starting a fire. By July, a few months after the American Rescue Plan had passed, economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal said that Americans should be bracing for levels of inflation not seen in more than 20 years. And that dire prediction was actually an underestimation of what we're now seeing. These are not politically motivated criticisms. These were not criticisms coming from Republicans or conservatives who hoped to limit what the Biden administration could achieve politically or were hoping to hang high inflation around Democrats' necks in advance of the midterms. These were sober assessments from mainstream academics and economists, one of whom had served in the Obama administration, and the White House consistently ignored or downplayed those concerns, going so far as to claim that inflation last summer was merely a transitory problem, which of course we now know is not the case. That history matters because the White House's latest attempt to explain away 40-year high inflation is to blame Russian President Vladimir Putin and the war that he started in Ukraine. Here's what Biden had to say on Friday.
Make no mistake, the current spike in gas prices is largely the fault of Vladimir Putin. It has nothing to do with the American Rescue Plan.
It's true that gas prices have spiked dramatically in the few weeks since Russian troops crossed the border into Ukraine, but Biden's attempt to pin a year of steadily rising prices on the events of the past few weeks makes little sense if you think about it for more than 5 seconds. For one thing, last week's report from the Labor Department showing that inflation had hit 7.9% looked at prices from February of 2021 through February of 2022. Putin's invasion of Ukraine began on February 24th, so the White House is effectively asking you to ignore 361 days worth of data in favor of focusing on what happened during the last 4 days of February. And it is, of course, certainly possible that the war in Ukraine and the disruptions that it is causing to global supply chains, particularly those for fuel and food, will put more upward pressure on prices. And we will probably see that in the next official report on inflation, which will come out in early April, looking at data from March. And the White House is also correct that energy prices are rising faster than prices overall. Overall, energy prices are up 25% since last year, and gasoline prices are up 38%. But if all of that is Putin's doing, how do you explain the fact that energy prices, and gasoline prices specifically, have been rising faster than just about anything else for most of the past year? In November, energy prices were up 33% from a year before, and gasoline prices were up 58%. In August of last year, those numbers were 25% and 42% respectively. What's happening here is obviously something that runs deeper than just the events of the past few weeks. So that brings us all back around to the economists who were warning last year that Biden's stimulus bill would be a recipe for high inflation. It's unlikely that Siegel, Summers, and the rest of them had a crystal ball that told them Russia was going to invade Ukraine in February of 2022. No, what they were predicting, and indeed what we are now seeing, was persistently rising prices due to an excessive amount of money being dumped into the economy. And any attempt by the Biden administration to explain inflation that doesn't include a hard look at its own policies is just dishonest. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of inflation and Ukraine and everything else going on in the world this week at Reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Ukrainian President Zelensky is asking for more help from the United States as his nation fights off Russian invaders. On his American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says, we should give him the tools to finish the job.
Weakness is provocative. That's true in schoolyards, divorce proceedings, political confrontations, labor and trade negotiations, and in foreign policy. But while the consequences of weakness can be overcome or even tolerated in many of those arenas, perceived military weakness and indecisiveness can provoke war, cause untold humanitarian misery, and produce an entire reset of the world order. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich earlier this week said that the Biden administration is, quote, the most timid, cowardly, and pathetic administration in modern American history, unquote. While that bleak assessment may well be accurate, it's also not too late to do what's right. In President Zelensky's Ukraine, we have an ally with the will to fight that exceeds the average will to fight of the entire Russian military, even if President Zelensky's own will is matched by that of the obsessive Vladimir Putin. Napoleon once famously said, "In war, the moral is to the physical as 3 is to 1. Ukraine has the moral advantage. Putin has the physical advantage. With adequate armaments, Ukraine can leverage its moral advantage. In Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, Our allied host nations didn't have the will to fight that the Ukrainians are showing, so analogies with how those conflicts turned out in the end are inappropriate. In President Zelensky's powerful address to the U.S. Congress on Wednesday, he pleaded for the weaponry that would close the sky to Russian aircraft. High-altitude bombers, low-altitude attack aircraft, troop carriers, helicopters, and cruise missiles. Below about 11,000 feet, the American Stinger missiles are relatively easy to fire and deadly effective. They were a major factor in the Mujahideen's defeat of the Russians in Afghanistan 40 years ago, so the Russian military is well acquainted with them. They're no longer being manufactured, and the United States should send every available Stinger missile in our possession or that of our allies to Ukraine immediately. There are approximately 17,000 Stingers in the world today. President Biden initially sent just 200 to Ukraine. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz sent 500. This week, Biden promised another 800. We should send thousands more and implore our allies to do the same. Much of the devastation being wrought in Ukraine is coming from Russian aircraft flying above the 10,000 to 12,000-foot ceiling of the Stingers. At higher altitudes, a long-range surface-to-air missile system, or SAM, is required. The Ukrainian military is trained on and familiar with one of the best SAMs in the world, the Soviet and Russian-built S-300. Slovakia has offered to send some of theirs to Ukraine. We should offer to replace them with Patriots, the superior U.S. equivalent to the S-300. They are inherently a defensive weapon system, so President Biden has little excuse not to offer Patriots directly. We should expedite as many as possible to Ukraine, along with advisors who can teach the Ukrainians how to use them. We have over 1,000 Patriot launchers and over 10,000 Patriot missiles. Much has been made about the refusal of the U.S. to send fighter aircraft, whether aging MiGs, owned by some of our allies, or more modern American fighter and attack aircraft, to establish an effective no-fly zone over Ukraine, or as President Zelensky likes to say, to close the sky to Russian aircraft. Rather than wring our hands in frustration over Biden's timidity, it's plausible that Stingers, S-300s, and Patriots can close the skies as effectively as manned fighter aircraft. While we can bemoan Biden's timidity about authorizing a no-fly zone, we may be able to get to the same objective another way. Timing is what's critical. We must move as fast as logistically possible. Many comparisons between Ukrainian President Zelensky and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill have been drawn in the last few weeks, so it's appropriate to close this commentary with one of Churchill's most eloquent pleas. Give us the tools and we will finish the job. We did then, and we must now, but even faster. If we don't, Moldova, Georgia, the Baltics, and Taiwan may also fall, and the very thing Biden fears most, a third world war, will be upon us. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KTLX-FM in Columbus, Nebraska, WMBS-AM and FM in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, along with KWFM-FM in Wichita Falls, Texas. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.